This program was first broadcast on Otago Access Radio and made with the assistance of New Zealand On Air.
Sustainable Lens, Resilience on Radio. Hear an informed, intelligent and provocative discussion of sustainability issues every week. It's brought to you by Otago Polytechnic, where all students learn how to make their industries more sustainable. The regular panel of Samuel Mann and Shane Gallagher are hosted by Anton Angelo and joined every week by a leading figure in the sustainability scene. Politics, science and controversy on Sustainable Lens on Radio, tonight at 7 o'clock, and podcast on www.sustainablelens.org or www.oar.org.nz. Welcome to the Sustainable Lens on Radio, a weekly show on sustainable topics hosted by myself, Anton Angelo, and regular panellist Samuel Mann, Professor of the Department of Information Technology and Education for Sustainability at the Otago Polytechnic, and Shane Gallagher, spokesman for the New Zealand Green Party, lefty, techie, and generally all-round good bloke. Tonight's guest we'll be talking to later is Stephen Browning, current Green MP. As usual, we'll start with Shane's number of the week. What have we got for us?
My number of the week is 3.5. That's 3.5%. And unfortunately, this is kind of a little bit complicated, so I'm going to talk a little bit about it. So the Ministry for Education of Environment has released its latest inventory report on our net CO2 equivalent emissions. And what they've discovered is that they're actually the total emissions in 1990, as reported in this submission, are 3.5% lower than the 1990 levels of greenhouse gas emissions as reported in 2006. And I think, hey, that's great. So we've actually reduced the number of greenhouse gases we overestimated. But what it is we've actually just changed the methodology by which we measure our greenhouse gas emissions. And what this is really telling us is that we are, it's really difficult to measure greenhouse gas emissions. It's really, really complicated. And a lot of what the technical, a lot of the technical disagreements around, your emissions levels are around things like, how much CO2 is being absorbed out of the atmosphere by your new forest growth. How much is being released by your old, so you chop down an old tree, turn it into wood. Is that actually releasing carbon into the atmosphere? Because at the moment, the Kyoto rules actually treat that as being released into the atmosphere. But of course, the wood is actually physically maybe in a house or part of a piece of furniture, so it's locked up. But it's treated as if it's being burnt. And so there's a lot of very, very technical things around how you actually measure your greenhouse gas emissions and how you then actually measure your carbon credits, because people pay you to take carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere. How do you measure that? How do you actually measure the amount of carbon dioxide you're taking out of the atmosphere? Because really, all it is guessing. It's informed guesswork, but essentially it's just guesswork.
All science is informed guesswork.
It is to an extent. This one is particularly so.
Guessworthy,
exactly. Yeah. So it turns out that our gross emissions, so the ones that we know we're taking, so many million tons of oil in and burning that. So we know our gross emissions have remained fairly static since about 1990. Really, since about 2004, they've remained static. And they've done a little bit of an increase. So we're talking about from 60,000 gigatons CO2 equivalents up to nearly 80,000. So that's, it's a fair increase, but not huge. And then it's remained fairly static since then. But our net emissions have actually increased. And so the net emissions, that's the idea that we're burning oil, but we're growing forests, growing trees, and those trees grab CO2 from the atmosphere. And the unfortunate trend is our net emissions are actually starting to increase again, and that's since 2006. And so back in 2010, we're back where we were in 2008. So we saw a net decrease in our greenhouse gas emissions. Now we're suddenly seeing an increase again. So we really need to put some policies in place to get those net emissions down.
Part of me is starting to wonder, does this mean that the mechanisms we have in place to restrict put some cost behind CO2 emissions into the atmosphere, is that just not working?
No, it's not. And we've created this ETS, which is the emissions trading scheme, and then we've skewed the market massively by excluding agriculture, which is our major gas CO2 emitter, greenhouse gas emitter, and transport is kind of half in, half out, and a lot of our major emitters are not really in there. And what was happening is the ordinary people are having to pay, you know, we're subsidizing the farmers and the other big emitters. So one of the simplest things to do, and it's been proposed many times, is actually just have a carbon tax. So you actually put a price on carbon. It's a direct carbon tax, and everyone, you know, just pays a carbon tax. And
this is the fat tax.
Yeah, this is the fat tax. Yes, and well, it's really more of a burp tax.
Okay,
yeah, and that's that's really what we want to do. That'd be a much simpler system than the ETS. A lot of people thought the ETS would be really good, but it's turned out to be quite, you know, even be quite corrupted. Quite easily, and so we're thinking that might not be the best solution. And really, a lot of this is around accounting. So what we really want to do is get actual real carbon dioxide emissions down. So, yeah.
Okay. Thank you very much. So three and a half. Can you remember what the figure was?
2.5% is the percent lower. Okay. So the total emissions.
This just boggles me. This just all the okay.
I know. Yeah. It's kind of crazy number. It is.
Yeah. Okay. Right. Thank you very much, Shane. Well, quickly, we'll just get a word from our sponsor, and then we'll talk to Sam, to Professor Samuel Mann, and with his joined up thinking.
At Otago Polytechnic, we've made a commitment to sustainability in all that we do. High quality, hands on education is our trademark, and it's delivered with a focus on sustainable practice. We even have a school dedicated to it, our Centre for Sustainable Practice. For more information, check out our website, otagopolytechnic.ac.nz. A bright future is a sustainable future. Otago Polytechnic, proud sponsor of Sustainable Lens.
Hi, Sam. What's your joined up thinking for today?
I've been thinking a bit about imagery, how we're selling the story of sustainability. There's a new report out by the World Watch Institute in preparation for the Rio 20 Plus conference coming up in the next couple of months called State of the World 2012, Moving Towards Sustainable Prosperity. And in that, there is a chapter by Michael Rennie which asks whether sustainability can be achieved as economies continue to grow and what that might mean. And he identifies two things that need to happen. One of them is degrowth in the rich countries and green growth in the developing countries. Of course, we know from Hans Rosling, which we've talked about, that that's not a distinct line. It's sort of, you know, line up all the countries along a continuous line. And in another chapter in the book, Eric Asadurian talks about a path to that degrowth position. So the sort of the question then is, you know, what are we saying with this degrowth? Is that a sensible place to be, or what does it mean? And we can see that the economic crisis is forcing degrowth in quite a sort of a catastrophic, socially catastrophic, psychologically devastating ways. So rather than a starvation method, which is what sort of being forced on, particularly the sort of the middle classes at the moment, not to diminish the starvation that's happening in the extreme poverty, but to, just to stretch the metaphor a bit. So because we need to move to a position where it's more of a long-term lifestyle change rather than a starvation, because we still need to build that healthy tissue and muscle and so on. So in that chapter, they talk about the crash of the affluent middle class And so the challenge then is, how can we return to a more equitable middle class as opposed to the runaway affluent, excessive materialistic version of development middle class that we've been seeing? So the challenge is, how can we have a higher quality of life in an era of less consumption? Reviewing the book, Ethan Goffman refers to that as, we need to look for a restabilization that's less materialistic. So how do we sell this idea? Matthew Hooton, talking on the radio, on national radio the other day, characterized the Greens as imagining, inventing a trade-off between environment and society. Mm-hmm. I don't think that that's the position that the Greens take. We explored that quite a lot in the election campaign last year. So what's another way we can look at it? We could look at that as, if we're talking about excessive consumption, then the obvious metaphor that we can look at is that of obesity. That, you know, as a steady state grown up adult, putting on weight is not a good thing. So we want to develop within that environment. Or we could look at it in terms of steroid abuse, in terms of, you know, how a cyclist's winning the Tour de France by cheating on the amount of the style of development. They're bulking up too much.
Mm.
And so people talk about rather than the underdeveloped and developed countries, that maybe we need to be recognizing the overdeveloped countries. So it's a worthwhile read.
But with the metaphor of obesity, the overdeveloped becomes a lovely euphemism. He's just a little overdeveloped.
Indeed.
It's an economy with big bones.
Well, and you you could refer to the body mass index as the graph that's currently sort of being used as the measure of sustainability of a country, is to plot the ecological footprint against the human development index. And there are a couple of countries in that sustainable place on that, which is sort of a reasonable human development index, but keeping below the threshold of the ecological footprint. And so that, you know, that's exactly the same sort of as the body mass index. Mm.
Thank you very much. That actually provides me much food for thought. We will come back to this in the next couple of weeks, I'm sure, because it's going to be interesting to tie the focus on the middle class. And which I think is always an important, very important part of society in terms of getting anything actually done, because they're enormously they're much the movers and shakers, and also the idea of happiness and the idea of sustainable growth and how do we but degrowth, I'm not so sure about that as a sellable slogan.
It doesn't sound good, but it does. It does sort of move it away from growth or not growth. It sort of puts another end of the continuum, I suppose.
I think we need a phrase for this.
Yeah, because it's not about reducing the human development.
Mm.
It is about reducing the ecological footprint while maintaining that human development index in the right place. And that's things. That's not how many cars do you drive. That's things like child mortality is the components that go into there.
Yeah. Okay, thanks very much, Sam. We're just going to go and listen to some music now. This is from the Free Music Archive. This is Plush Goulash with Big Gay Water Fight. We'll be right back. Welcome back to the Sustainable Lens on Radio. Tonight's guest is Stephen Browning, current Green MP, one of the new crop of Green MPs in the first Parliament. He's been employed as a spokesperson for the Soil and Health Association and is a successful horticulturalist, running New Zealand's largest certified organic greenhouse operation only just a few years ago. Oddly enough, his primary interest is in agriculture and safe food. Hi, Stephen. Welcome to the show. I'd like to ask you, just to begin with, a little bit about your history. You were a pharmaceutical rep. Is that right?
Well, I was a long, long time ago. I'd come down to Dunedin once a month for Charlens, who was a chemist wholesalers.
Yeah.
They did everything from shampoo to pethidine. And,
sure.
And I was in a suit then. In fact, it was in those days when I actually dropped out of that and went for a more alternative lifestyle and got involved with my true passion, I guess, was sustainability and sustainable agriculture. So I got out of a suit now I'm back in one.
So fortunately you weren't working for Roche or Monsanto. That's a kind of the...
They were product lines, I guess, but I was really an audit promoter. In fact, when we had to do promotions, I quite often felt uncomfortable and that was part of why I got out of it.
Sure.
Yeah.
Sure.
Tell me more about your sustainable agriculture.
Right. Sustainable agriculture, I'm involved with the organic certification body, BioGrow, and I'm still, for a very short time, on the National Council of Soil and Health Association, that I was a spokesperson with them since 2003. But on a personal level, I didn't want to use toxic pesticides. So even when I was doing some sort of garden contracting around Christchurch in those sort of early days and in my mid-20s, I just wouldn't use those pesticides. I think that came from a deep interest in ecology that came from both probably from home but also from various teachers at school and I can remember my sixth form biology text that had such a strong focus on ecology and just that interrelationship between different organisms. So I've followed through with that, and I've also been involved with marine sustainability issues. And in fact, last night was at a Sustain Our Sounds meeting in Blenheim over the intention by New Zealand King Salmon to expand the salmon farming operation into areas currently prohibited to marine farming. So both got a terrestrial and a marine sustainability interest.
Where did the actual skills come from? Is it parents or grandparents that you picked those up?
I was lucky to be in the half-acre section days. My family had moved from Otago. I was brought up in Blenheim from the age of four. We had a big section running down to a river. And the garden was always a major part there. I have to say that I was really self-taught in terms of my glasshouse operation. I was a glasshouse grower primarily, plastic tunnels, some of them out in the Marlborough Sounds when I first went out there. And then my latter years of leasing a older glasshouse property in Blenheim that was... had several staff there, and there was quite a big operation. But that I have to say, mostly that was self-taught. And I went hunting. I'd go to conventional glass house operators, and with my German partner at the time, went to Europe and had a look at the Dutch organic glass houses as well, and to see how I was stacking up. And I was stacking up just fine, which was heartening. In fact, we won the Marlborough Environment Awards one year for horticulture and also the Supreme Award for the operation. And so the staff had really bought into what we were about and lifting the soil health and consequent the whole operation.
Did those conventional people think you were nuts?
Not 100%, which is comforting, but they thought I could be more commercially focused. I mean, we were commercially focused enough. We were trying to stay upright, and we did.
So it was a big operation. It was profitable.
Oh yes, it was. It was still profitable to the end, but I must admit my commercial focus started to drift from about 2003 when I was doing a lot more environment court type advocacy and stuff like that, and it sort of caught my attention. But there was a lease change, and I was also a strong candidate for the 2005 election, so I thought good time to bow out, and did. But those the same conventional people ended up buying into the biological controls that I was using more and more, and spraying less and less in their own glasshouse operations. Unfortunately, they've got the psyllid, a new pest, and nobody's finding an easy solution for that. So a lot of them have gone back into spraying and glasshouse tomatoes, cucumbers, capsicum, whatever, from especially the areas that have got the psyllid will be fairly well pesticide-ridden, I would suggest, these days. And, so there's a challenge.
Just a more general question. Do you think that a commercial focus and a sustainable focus are counterposed?
No, they're not. One little problem we have, and it's quite a big problem, is the price of food. We all want food to be affordable, but it's not priced due to its true cost of production.
Mm.
And so while we're getting subsidised food because producers have to they have to be more and more intensive just to survive. One lettuce grower a few years ago said to me, "Hey, look, I get $1.50 a lettuce." And he said, "I got $1.50 10 years ago." So, of course, his costs, his, you know, issues around his family and all of that, rates, whatever it is all carrying on. And so that downward price pressure, and that's run by the supermarkets a lot. You know, I mean, consumers want cheaper food, although they're paying considerably less relative to their income than they did, say, 40 years ago and maybe 50 years ago. So there's been a change in dynamic of what people spend their money on. In that era, people were growing a lot more of their own food as well, and yet it was still a big part of their budget. And it's the people really look what they're spending on food now, and they cringe when they have to pay that extra bit. But it's still quite a lot. It's not the biggest part of their budget by any stretch. And I'd suggest mortgages and widescreen tellies are a big part of that. In saying that, we need to get food to be affordable, so we need to look at the supermarket pricing regimes, and some would say bring in some competition.
Mm.
I would suggest that's a very dangerous thing, because it's likely to be a German supermarket chain if we did. And so all those profits will be heading off overseas. I would rather see a consumer cooperative alternative maybe built up through the country.
Well, we can see what's happened with the price of milk when there is a cooperative who's got it based. Where there is some leverage to be able to do something about it politically. Where against a commercial operation, of course, you always have the argument: well, it's the market. It's what people can pay. So are we saying the market is not the most – the free market, the open market, is not the most efficient way of dealing with this, or not the – what's the word?
Well, the market might do it just fine if all the costs were put in. That's going back to the production part.
Yeah.
And it's not the selling end. If the supermarkets are cranking up margins heavily – I don't think.
Yeah.
Market might have if it was big enough. The market is generally in a lot of things. We say our market forces will sort it out. Quite often, there's a bit of a lag until that happens. There's a lot of pain or extra costs, and while that's sorted out, so it may need intervention yet. But back on the production part of it, if we were able to do the polluter pays principle and find put in some costs associated with some of the pesticides and the nitrogen and the phosphorus use and the production. And so producers that were actually way more sustainable became more competitive because they didn't have these penalties added on. That would help balance that out.
How does the economics of home gardening pan out? Is it worthwhile doing?
I think it's always worthwhile doing because, for one, food is generally healthier. It's fresher and it's quicker between the garden and the plate. So the nutritional part will be better, and often people will do that relatively organically. So less pesticide residues as well. It's not to say that people don't, and I think pesticides should be coming out of the supermarket shelves, to be honest. There's people being able to use pesticides at home that a commercial operator would have to jump through the hoops and do grow safe courses and stuff like that, and to make sure that they weren't misusing them and as they would describe it. But in terms of the cost, I think so. There's sometimes you might say, well, on a space basis, I'm probably still better off to buy my spuds and maybe even carrots of a year, or say onions. But it's very, very satisfying as well. It's got another measure to be picking your own from your own place. Certainly salad materials, there's nothing to stop people growing their own, and just, I would say the more the better. It's interesting to see what size sections people have, and I think here in Dunedin there's still some adequate size areas for people to be growing a reasonable amount of garden in their own space.
Taking it up a level, we've had people on the show that have described themselves as locavores and people very passionate about farmers markets and things. Is that something that we should be focusing on?
Yes, I think so. I think local food resilience and self-reliance is very important. More and more, we're getting an increasing amount of imported goods. We certainly move stuff around the country a lot, and a lot of that's totally unnecessary. But in terms of potential oil, energy cost increases, natural disasters, Christchurch gave us a little snap example of what might happen when in Christchurch the bread factories, for example, stopped, and even up in my hometown of Blenheim, the shelves suddenly were empty of bread, because they're relying on this sort of centralised food production. So that was, while it didn't last too long, was a very, very good indicator. Supermarkets went out there, and the farmers' markets really built up quite quickly in Christchurch. There already were some, but their profile has lifted, and I think it seems like it's lasting, even though the supermarket structures have come.
There wasn't any milk in Dunedin, despite the fact the milk gets driven through Dunedin up to Christchurch and then back again.
Yes.
It was crazy.
So the more the better, and that's one way of pushing back against the big machine, you might say, that doesn't always have our individual interests foremost.
How would you actually do that? How would you start constructing a society that was, more resilient in that way, structurally?
It's a tricky one, because people will still buy with by price, and as I say, local production or good sustainable production sometimes works out to be a little more expensive. I'm always for a producer getting a good fair return at the gate, because we want our producers, our family farmers, to stay on the land and be there for generations. To do it structurally is a real tricky one. I think it requires an element of intervention, or certainly support to help. It's good to see that the farmers market, the locavore sort of thing, is happening anyway, but in a way. I know in my hometown it was considered our farmers market was elitist, because it was sort of a middle class thing and only those that could afford it, because it wasn't those bargain basement prices. And it was, a farmers market is not meant to be a bargain sales type place. It should be at least full retail, because those people have worked hard, they deserve it. And they're producing a fine product. I haven't got a real easy answer on how to move it that way in a you must do it sort of thing. Government could do more on a more macro scale. We used to have different, like, wheat boards. We've got a milk one equivalent with Fonterra. We have kiwi fruit, and the pip fruit got obliterated thanks to turners and growers and others. And so producers, even be they be exporters, have really struggled since then. But the wheat board and the Australian one has just been gone down to a big American, I think, outfit has taken over their wheat board. But the wheat board would, for example, it would buffer the prices to farmers. So on a lean year, they would still get a base sort of income. And a high year, it would hold some of the funds for the, against those lean years. So both, but that worked out to the consumers too, that, you know, in the processes and whatever. Everyone sort of had a bit of an idea, and there was no quick, sudden changes or anything like that. They could, some of those sort of structures could come back in, and that might help that sort of local food self-reliance. Government should have a policy on that, because you know, we are vulnerable, we're remote country, and while they seem to think that everything will just go along tickety-boo,
they do have a policy, the market will solve everything.
Yeah, yeah, and no matter whether it comes from Canada or, you know, and maybe Africa, you know, we start to become reliant on really big distant foods. So, yeah.
I mean, is there an awareness that we've reached peak oil and that we're starting to, you know, enter into a very vulnerable and, you know, an unpredictable age?
I don't see it in, for example, the Primary Production Select Committee. You know, in discussions there, we don't, and I'm young to it yet. You know, Parliament only got underway properly in February, and so, you know, we've got stuff like the Dairy Restructuring Bill coming along, and they had the Food Bill before I got there and the likes. There'll be some awareness, but there'll be, oh, yeah, sort of out there sort of approach. I don't think it's they're soaking in it and having that real deep understanding. I think the Greens do it very well. You know, in terms of getting those statements out and holding the government to account on that and pointing out, well, just a moment, what's happening here? We're great on the roading issues and the likes, but I haven't seen any sign of it in terms of government coming through into food.
So you come from a background of shoveling compost, and now you're an now you're an MP.
How did you describe that?
Vegan compost.
So what's it like being an MP?
It's exciting, and it's certainly exciting being in 14 of us. There's big energy and there's a lot of enthusiasm. I'm still settling in. For a while there, I found it quite sort of daunting. I had my own sort of expectations, trying to catch up with what I thought was expected of me and what others, you know, probably do. Look, understanding the processes of Parliament, there's a really good induction process, but there's one hell of a lot of information in a very quick time there. And then you sort of bit by bit actually do it experientially as well. Very exciting being able to interview people that might not have given you an appointment before. And, for example, we have the financial reviews of the government department. So the Director General of MAF and all the top brass come along to be asked questions about the financial review. So, you know, I was able to ask stuff around, you know, policies around, you know, certainly around the food, but fisheries, forestry, and, you know, agriculture in general, and biosecurity. That sort of thing is really good, and I'm sure it's going to be better in a year when they come back for another round where I've got a better feel for it.
So does and things, places like the Primary Production Select Committee, the fishery people report to that, don't they?
Yeah.
So is that where the big questions get asked? Like, is the quota management system working in terms of sustainability? That gets asked?
That's the sort of question. The questions are asked through their financial review process. Yeah. I think it could be more robust. It's right in front of me, and Labor asked a few good questions in terms of that. There were some okay questions from National too, I guess. It's just seven of us on there. They've got four Nats and Shane Jones and Damien O'Connor and Stephen Browning, and that's the Primary Production Select Committee. So clearly, you know, there's stronger, more delving questions come from opposition parties.
But whenever people are critical of what goes on in the House itself, they say, oh, but the real work goes on in the select committees. Mm. Does it really? Do you think that that's the real powerhouse?
That's the within the House, and you see the banter going on, and but particularly when the bills are just being rolled through anyway because the government's got it stacked in terms of numbers and isn't really, you know, it's got its agenda, it's pushing through. So you do speeches in there, I've done several, and it's not changing the path of the bill. You know, it's not, oh, okay, hell, we must change that. You know, that's not happening. But in the select committee, you've got cross-party discussion and submissions and can be, you know, quite reasoned stuff. I'm heading into my first bill from scratch in there, and that's a dairy industry restructuring amendment bill, which is complex as anything because it's, wet shares, dry shares.
This is the Fonterra farmers trading shares thing.
Yeah, and then the trading amongst farmers one and the milk pricing part, which is the milk pricing at the farm gate, not the supermarket aisle. So that is complex. It'll be, and we are under huge pressure. The submitters under great pressure. Everything's in a real tight time frame because the government says we've got a reporting date and back date by X, and which ended up being a very small time for submitters. So that will my May will be rather interestingly. It'll be a great experiment for me. Not really experiment's the wrong word, but a new path to see something through in that sense.
Now, I see you've got a great big, we've mentioned it before, there's a great big thing on the table in front of us. It doesn't seem to smell of brimstone. I can't see it glowing in the dark. It's the food bill. Now, all I understand about the food bill is some things that have arrived to me through blogs and various discussions on Facebook that it is a terrible thing and that it will kill home vegetable gardens and with the power of Roundup. Is that true? Can you talk me through it?
Okay, yeah. There was a ton of stuff through social media through Christmas.
Mm.
We've been told we were meant to have the month of January off on holiday to be ready for this parliamentary year. But there were people emailing and doing stuff on social media on Christmas Day and certainly Boxing Day onwards, which I thought, what are the Greens doing about this? How come this and all of that? So it seemed to, a new MP took that on quite solidly.
Mm.
Some of what they were saying was slightly wrong, and there'd been a bit of Indian whispers around that. There was a petition went out, more than 40,000 people have signed it. I signed it as well. But some of the preamble wasn't quite right. It said that, for example, that you weren't going to be able to save your own seed, and Monsanto would be down through as the food police and jumping on us all and that sort of thing. The minister been really clear that there had been an oversight, and that seeds for propagation had inadvertently been caught up as well as seeds that we might eat. So we eat pumpkin seed, we eat wheat, we eat all of those sorts of things, and potatoes, they're propagation material. But the way that was written, which is fine in terms of food safety, it caught up all seed. And clearly there needed to be a statement to say that seed for propagation isn't intended. I haven't seen their draft amendment yet, but I have no doubt that there will be one because the minister's written so many letters and said so many public statements about it that she'll follow through with that. It was also that the food police as such, being food safety officers, but often described in that media police.
The pork police.
So,
the pork police I've heard it described as well, which I think is really unfortunate, of course. Yeah.
So they would be able to come in and tell you what you could do in your own backyard.
Mm.
A lot of that, when I looked through the bill, I thought, as it's written, yes, and sort of like that. So the sort of conspiracy theory type approach, you could sort of follow a path how you could maybe interpret parts of the bill that way. I put it to the minister and staff there that if they just did a few words, put a little context, a little bit of explanatory stuff in the bill, it could solve a lot of public angst. She's quite clear that the home garden is to be sacrosanct and not be caught up by the bureaucracy that the bill creates or continues. It's already do have a food act that effectively is covering most of the stuff the bill does. And they're saying, oh, it's not in there. However, the word barter is caught up as a meaning of sale. And for a lot of people, barter is just the sort of handing over the back fence and, you know, one day I give you a cabbage and then, you know, you some carrots.
I'm a grateful recipient of radishes over the fence. I really am. Yeah.
Radishes. Yeah. Yep. Okay. So, and then, you know, it's just that stuff goes on. And we may, on one level, call that barter. Barter is really probably better described as where there's a value attributed to something and you're doing trade of, but without cash. So the IRD has barter included. It says barter is a sale.
Mm.
But because of that sort of grey area or crossover, we've said, hey, you need some words around that. You should be absolutely clear that the distribution or amongst neighbours and along the street and rallies and the likes isn't caught up. They've toyed with some words, but we're yet to see an amendment for that as well.
And it
will be excluded, but I believe they need to add some words in. It's excluded as it stands.
Sure.
Except a lawyer could, you know, or a future minister might interpret it.
So just nice and slowly for me, why would it need to be excluded? What would it, if it was included, what would it mean I could or couldn't do?
The bureaucracy, I'll pop up into a small commercial grower level.
Yeah.
Or maybe even a home gardener that has plenty of surplus and wants to get down to the railway station here on a Saturday morning and sell it at the farmer's market. As long as they can, you can see the producer can see the whites of the client's eyes, they will be able to have no bureaucracy over them at all. They'll be subject to a thing called food handler guidance, which means the local council or food safety officers might come along and poke a A4 in front of them that's got some basic smart ways of looking after your food to reduce any food safety risks. We don't know what that is yet, but that's all it is. It's voluntary, and they will not come back to verify that you're following that. You'll be left alone, but there'll be educational material out there. If you come up the next notch and you've got a couple of crates of produce left over after the market and you want to sell to Taste Nature or the corner dairy or something, then you would have to go up into what they call a national program. There you would have to register $50 or $100, something like that, and then you would have to also have at least one verification, and that would be about $140 an hour for the verification officer to look at your operation. And that would same go for someone making jams or pickles and up. So there's a range of levels. There's food handler guidance, no bureaucracy leaning it onto you. As soon as you cross some thresholds or you're processing the food, you'd be into these national programs. There's programs 1, 2, 3, and then you've
got... You can still sell jams at the school fair.
Right, well, that's another thing again, but yes. We've said, I'll just stick with a small grower at the moment.
Mm-hmm.
We've said that, hey, look, we want to encourage local production, local food self-reliance, all of that stuff. So we don't want anything to be pushing down on that. We don't need any bureaucracy. We seriously don't need it. Let's not have any. Because it's hard. It is seriously hard being a producer, a small producer. You need the other day job sort of thing almost. Mm. So the last thing we need is them to be paying $50, $100, which might not be much, but then verification things on top of it. Just if you don't need it, get rid of it. But what we've had a problem there is finding what a threshold would be, what size of an operation before you'd have to come under that. They've said, look, fear not, we'll give exemptions. for these, but we won't be able to tell you what they'll be until after the bill's through. And the bill is very, very powerful for the minister and MAF. This is just a framework. As big as it is, it's 366 pages. It's still actually still the framework. It's all telling about how the minister can make regulation on absolutely anything and everything afterwards. And in a way, they need to, because a rule around bean sprouts will be quite different than maybe cabbages or salamis. And if you start to put every little strand and every food iteration, and maybe you make the jam, it's got pectin, and this one's got this and that, and there's a bit of a tweak of risk change. To be in the bill would probably take up most of this room. It would be fairly large. So I have some sympathy towards the officials around and the fact for regulation. But what we could do is push back and have some thresholds. So you've got some areas that have just leave us alone and let us get on with it without coming down into that, because the risk is really low. As long as we have good traceability where people, if there is a problem, can track back where it came from, it'll be fine.
So are you comfortable that this bill's not being driven by the lobbyists from the big food companies or from the Monsanto-type places?
It does fit for the export world, and partly what the motivation for this is that it is similar to export standards. So they want the sort of seamless thing. I get a bit nervous around that. One of the concerns is that if we have some nasty sort of food-borne illness outbreak here, it will reflect badly on New Zealand and affect our exports. And so they want the bill to be strong. We do have a Food Act. This isn't new. It's just has some changes. A lot of people said in that social media stuff it's come straight from the States, and I've looked at the American food bill stuff, total different format, a different language style and all that. It may have similar outcomes, but it's certainly not been cut and pasted from there. I haven't looked at the Canadian one, which I'm told looks closer, and the other one is some parts of Codex, which is where some of the international is the international food standards setting body. It's not necessarily a problem, because I remember being on the board of trustees at a school, and when we had to do policy for this and policy for that, you'd check out what the school down the road had, and then you'd tweak it around, and you put it in, and it worked just fine. You'd modify to suit. So where it comes from is not necessarily a problem. It's a matter of whether we've got food sovereignty, whether we've still got full control over our domestic food stuff, and whether those external forces can keep driving through. I feel it can, because of the level of what the minister can do under regulation. When the minister makes regulation, they have to take into account, one, says food safety. Okay, that's good. Next is the joint partnership with Australia, where we do our Food Standards Australia, New Zealand, FSANs, and that's good and bad. And then other international agreements, protocols, treaties, blah, 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 and there's something else of that vein as well. It's not necessarily prioritised in any way, but this international flavour is quite in there. And the minister will be able to regulate. So the TPPA, for example, Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement, and that's all happening in secret.
I'm glad you brought this up.
If they come through on something like that, and I believe there is a flavour, part of that's eking in here. Mm-hmm. I might have it wrong, but I'll be almost surprised if I am, that they come to some agreement in there, and then the minister can slide it through in regulation, which means, oh, yeah, they might consult, but consulting is telling us about what it's about, and you might say, oh, about this or whatever. The odds of them listening and taking that into account is low. And then it's just ticked off by Cabinet. It doesn't go through the Primary Production Select Committee or any process like that. So it's open to that. So, it is in there. And while it's, obviously saying, hey, this is fine in lots of ways, there are those risks around it. And the minister
that you'd give the minister carte blanche to.
She can even change, you know, okay, this is a national, you're in a national program here, one or two or three, or safety plan there or not. But total freedom to move different food things around that way. But some people think it's only about foodborne illness in terms of microbials. It's not. It's absolutely everything to do with food, except they took out one part, and that was genetic modification. And so their view is that genetic modification isn't a food safety issue. Said to the minister, yes, it is.
I thought it was an intellectual property issue.
Well, I think that's the way they see it as well. But in terms of food safety, they were told by the regulatory committee that the bill is far too open, because far too much regulatory power, and you should, you know, curb it back in this way and that. And they went through it, and the same stuff as I said, you know, it's got so many intricacies, food, so it has to be. You know, otherwise it's too huge to have in legislation. But in acknowledging that part, we'll take out genetic modification. This was some of the stuff in the Select Committee reports that I read as I came in. However, I could see that it was taken out. I thought, well, how do I want Kate Wilkinson making regulation around genetic modification? Probably not. Maybe this is okay. And then, of course, you know, thought a bit deeper. But then it still has the joint partnership. At the moment, our foods that are genetically modified, they go through the FSANS, the Food Standards Australia New Zealand process. So that's still in there. And I said, well, you're taking it out, but you've still got it there, so there's a contradiction. Now they've decided to take up on that, and they say, well, we don't need to have it in there because it's in the FSANS thing. I mean, I put that to them. They're disingenuous.
When you say they?
Officials, really.
Sure.
Because the minister might be party to it, but I know as an MP, without ministerial stuff, how much stuff you're trying to keep up with. She's really reliant heavily on the officials, and I think officials are driving this in some ways. And I've been involved with Food Safety, New Zealand Food Safety Authority, which is sort of like the policeman of food safety, where FSANS, Food Standards Australia New Zealand, sets the standard, involved with them a lot. And their thinking is very agribusiness, and that these smart, clever technologies are all fine and hunky-dory. Pesticide residues, well, they're not really a problem, and, you know, and whatever. But, you know, we withdraw pesticides from time to time. The GE, I'll just wrap up on that, on that aspect. FSANS has never said no to more than 70 different genetically engineered food lines in this country and for Australia. Some of them, the more recent ones, aren't even commercially grown yet, haven't been approved for commercial growing by the US Department of Agriculture, where they're going to be doing it first. That decision's coming up in a week or two. And yet they've ticked it through as safe for when it happens to come through. And that is soy and corn genetically engineered to resist 2,4-D and another herbicide. So that's because the Roundup that they are spraying over, they put up the maximum residue limits in food to cope with more glyphosate Roundup residues in your food. They've got weeds so resistant now, they want to come in with the heavier duty herbicides. So they're doing 2,4-D, the one half of Agent Orange, and another herbicide resistant. And they still didn't even have the maximum residue limit sorted out for that. And that's the nature of FSANS. So do we need genetic modification back in here? We sure as hell do. And while they're talking about, yes, we'll change a few words here and a few words there, that part they don't intend to change. So we've got a wee scrap ahead of us.
Cool.
So beyond the food bill, what are you hoping to achieve in the next 2.5?
Change of government. That would be very good because, seriously, you know, batting against bills or making statements on bills and they're just going through. By our speeches in Parliament, we're putting on record what the issues are, but we actually need to be a constructive part of a government. So What I'm hoping to do, I'll certainly be raising issues around genetic engineering, pushing against the push to get genetically engineered rye grasses and clovers into New Zealand. I would be doing some more work around the field trials, suggesting that GE should come out of the New Zealand environment. I suppose preparing to be part of a government in a way by learning the processes better and better, promoting a organic target for New Zealand. I've got issues around fisheries, issues around forestry, and
you probably a few haven't
other
had,
things.
You probably haven't had time yet to get a bill into the ballot.
No, I haven't prepared one.
What are you going to write first?
I'm not quite sure how quickly they'll come off the chocks, but there'll probably be a few coming in parallel around GE and organic target would probably be the first ones. I'm looking at some of the forestry issues. We've got a National Environment Standard Plantation Forestry due out shortly. I think it's going to be woeful in terms of protecting the New Zealand environment from the worst of forestry harvest practices. And there might be something that needs to come through in that line as well.
Thank you. Yeah. Thank you so much, Stefan. We'll have to wind it up. Once again, another fascinating show. And when those bills start coming through, we'd really like to talk to you again, actually, just to see how that's going. That would be very good indeed. You've been listening to Sustainable Dens on Radio, the weekly show broadcast on Otago Access Radio every Thursday from 7 till 8. Our guest tonight was Stefan Browning. Regular panelists are Shane Gallagher and Samuel Mann, and our website, www.sustainabledens.org, is where you can get podcasts of previous shows, as well as the Otago Access Radio site, oar.org.nz. You can look us up on iTunes as well. My name is Anton Angelo, and I hope you enjoyed the show.
This program was first broadcast on Otago Access Radio and made with the assistance of New Zealand On Air.